Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and in this podcast, I ask my guests to look back over their life and pick five things from it that they would like to put in a time capsule. Four things they love and would wish to preserve or have again, and one that they're happy to banish from their life and never have to see again. My very special guest this week playing this game of reminiscences with me is Sir David Jason OBE, or as he's known to the world, Del Boy. But Only Fools and Horses, memorable and successful as it clearly was, is just a tiny part of David's career, which has taken him from touring theatre shows to starring in the West End, to radio, to television shows such as Do Not Adjust Your Set, Open All Hours and Porridge with Ronnie Barker, A Bit of a Do, in which he played Ted Simcock. He also played Captain Frank Beck in All the King's Men, Scullion in Porterhouse Blue, Pop Larkin in The Darling Buds of May, and of course, Detective Inspector Frost in A Touch of Frost. He's won a number of British Comedy Awards, lots of National Television Awards, and four BAFTAs, including being made a Fellow. Most recently, he's been backed behind the counter, keeping Arkwright's shop going in Still Open All Hours. I mean, let's face it, David is a comedy legend and a national treasure. He recently released his autobiography, A Dell of a Life, which is a great read, I have to say. Well, I should know. I recorded it as an audiobook. Rather beautifully, I have to say. Anyway, to commemorate this event, David agreed to meet up with me at the Ivy Club in London and talk about the things he holds dear and one thing he'd like to bury in the ground and banish. This is that conversation.
Right, are you starting, Michael?
I am starting, yeah, that's okay. It. We're off we go. We're going to talk about five things from your life, little insignificant things that you'd like to put into a time capsule and preserve for posterity or for your daughter so that she can look at it and show your grandchildren.
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, but there is a story that's in the book, right? What I'm sort of mostly known for the general public, is, I suppose, Del Boy.
Yeah.
Eric Trotter for Fools and Horses, which I'm very proud of in a way, but it's a bit like a ghost. It keeps coming back to haunt you all the time. But fortunately, it has been a springboard for me to do other things which I'm equally proud of. And I'm grateful for it in one way, and it's been a sort of bittersweet thing in another. So the book is called A Dell of a Life. A Dell of a Life is a sort of play on words. Then let's say, you know, oh dear, oh dear, it's a bit of a hell of a life. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know what I mean, pal? So I would have that book, which is one of a trilogy, which is the third one that I've done. Mm. And I would put that to answer one of your questions.
Yeah.
And that is because it's a record of what I've done, and my catchphrase, which I try to say to everybody, and especially to my daughter, is it's the journey, not the arrival. So that means that I aimed for success, but I aimed to be better at what I was doing. That was my driving force.
Mm.
So what it did, it drove me to try and be self-analytical and self-judgmental onto my work, what I was doing.
Yeah, so critical of it.
Yes, yeah. And so I was constantly criticising myself. And I can tell you this, that when I was learnt the trade, I did it by coming through the theatre.
Yeah.
Now, where I suppose you and I have a sort of fond memory, and where we're very fortunate, is having some work, some continuity in the theatre, which meant that I could go on for hours and tell you all sorts of things about what I learned from different people that I worked with. But the one thing that started it all off in this analysis of what we're talking about is that I was doing Peter Pan, and I had a front cloth to do with a wonderful old musical actor called Leslie Cerrone. Now, Leslie Cerrone, he did a musical act many, many moons ago with another performer. They were called the Two Leslies, and they were so successful and famous. And for example, they used to write very funny ditties and things, and they were musical and they were private party sort of things. And he wrote Savannah's a Funnyful Man. Savannah's a Funnyful Man.
That did he?
Yes. And so he wrote Peg Leg Pete. And yes, there was so many musical songs that the Two Leslies wrote. And nine times out of ten, they were comic songs.
Yeah.
And so that one was typical. Now, I worked with him. We had such a good time. But the point of the story was that we had to do a front cloth, which was me, Leslie, and the crocodile, which we had a lad in a crocodile skin that came on wheels.
I wonder what happened to him, poor lad.
Poor lad.
Yeah.
Yes. There is a story, but I can't relate that here. what happened was that every night we used to go out, and our job was, amongst other things, I played the gentleman Starkey, which was quite a nice part in Peter Pan. And he played Smee. So we were a little double act, as it were, in the story of Peter Pan. But what they decided to do was that they put us on in a front cloth to entertain the audience whilst they changed their scene behind into the boat for the big finale scene for the thing. Anyway, we went out there every night and we did as wrote, as directed, right? Well, we used to go out there every night and die the death. Die the absolute death.
Ooh.
So we used to play the full houses with nothing.
Oh, dear.
I'll tell you what, there's nothing more humiliating and things to destroy you is if you got a heart and a soul.
Yeah.
As an actor, I mean, to experience that. And I kept saying to the director, can we do something? It's just not working. It's just not working. Could somebody write us some jokes? And said, listen, that's what's written. You just carry on and do it. You're doing a good job. The job is that you to do that whilst they change to the ship behind. So I suffered it for a while. Then I went to see Ron Moody, who was playing Captain Hook. And I said, Ron, it's not working, this front cloth. And he said, why? What do you mean? And I told him that wasn't getting a... Nobody was laughing. We're supposed to be funny. We're supposed to be doing silly, funny, making people laugh with a crocodile.
And it's also, you know, because of your instinct, it's not because you're doing it wrong. It's because it doesn't work.
Exactly. That's a very good point. And so I said to him, what should we do? Can you give me some jokes? And Ronnie said, well, what's the problem? And I said, well, the problem is not getting enough, but I'm doing as directed. And it's just, so that's what he was sort of waiting for. He says, he said, okay, so now what are you going to do? He said, are you going to listen to the director or are you going to listen to the audience? So I said, I paused for a minute or two and then I said, well, I'd listen to the audience. And he said, there's your answer. Mm. And I got on very, very well with Ron Moody. We were good mates, but we always used to go out together.
No, anyway,
so I left his dressing room. And on the way back to my dressing room, this was drip-feeding into my... Because I was expecting to get a whole list of jokes, then you do that, and then you do that.
Yeah.
But then it occurred to me that he's right. It's me and the audience. I have to do it. I have to learn, which was the greatest lesson that I basically ever had, and which I also had another lesson from my governor, Ronnie Barker. But the point of that little story was that was my training ground. In other words, I went out every night and I had to think of ways. What are we going to do? Right, I'll tell you what, we'll try this. So we set ourselves a course. Now, all I can say to you is this. I went totally against director, which I shouldn't be talking about this if you're a director. But I knew it in my heart and soul I couldn't go out there anymore and not entertain that audience. The last night of the entire show, I came off from that front cloth to wonderful rounds of applause.
Wow.
And the director that I walked past was standing in the wings because it was the last night. And he just looked at me and he said, that was absolutely brilliant. Well done. Yeah. And I bit my tongue.
Yes.
But what a learning curve that
absolutely.
Was.
Absolutely. And we should put that crocodile into the time capsule to remind you of that lesson.
Yes.
Always listen to the audience. That's item number one.
Yes. Yeah. Listen to the audience.
And you've applied that right through your career. I mean, the book is absolutely full of examples of that, of where you've pursued the comedy of it to the point where something that is quite small and seemingly not that funny, you know, a laugh, becomes a whole routine and gets a round of applause. So you develop it, you work on it, using the audience, listening to the audience.
Yeah.
I would remind you of something that I saw you do at the Oxford Playhouse in 1978, I think.
Yeah, go on.
You did a thing with a cornflake packet in
the Norman Conquest.
The Norman Conquest.
You're absolutely right. And that is a very good example.
That was a learning curve for me. Seeing you do that, I was only a student at the time. But yes. I saw you do that and I instantly knew that you'd done that. That you'd developed.
How did you know that?
Well, it just, the whole play sort of, in a way, stopped for a moment before the breakfast scene. And you did this fantastic routine where you had a cornflake packet, and as you poured it, the radio played a marching band. And then you looked at the cornflake packet, and then you looked at the radio, and then you stood up, and you went, by the left, quick, march! And you went...
That's it.
Across the stage.
Yeah.
And it got a massive round of applause.
Yes.
And I went back, and I bought a copy of the play.
Yeah.
And it's not in it.
No. Do you see, now that's an absolute example of what I'd learned from Ron Moody. And what it was, and this is important, that I was so absolutely, now I look back and you go, that learning the trade, the audience tell you things when you're using your brain. And it's so interesting that you brought that up because that was typical of me. If I found there was a need, a gap,
yes.
An instinct that's saying there's something missing here. I'm sure they're waiting to want something. I don't know what it is. And then you keep searching in your mind, you're going out every night, you're doing the play as wrote, and then something will occur to you. And then what occurred to me was I did that at home by accident. So what they then, with the stage manager and I, we worked to get the right material in the box to give you that sound loud enough for the audience to hear.
Of course, cornflakes would never do it.
No.
You see, I tried to repeat that gag.
Yeah.
I tried to steal it from you.
I'm sure you did, you swine.
I know. I thought it was such a funny thing. I tried it and I couldn't do it. And right at the end, I think somebody, we put a false bottom and gravel.
Yeah, it might have been something like that, to be fair.
Almost certainly that's what you did.
Yes.
But it took us a long time to work it out.
Yeah.
But it was it was foolproof.
Yeah.
So are you 20 quid?
Right, okay, you're on, love. The other thing in that play, which now you've reminded me, and I was talking about searching in your mind, but it's not, as I say, I was lucky you were working in the theatre. You've got to work with your fellow actors. You can't just keep doing things for yourself. You have to work as a team.
Yeah.
And you have to include your fellow actors, and they've got to get them to agree with you, because if they don't, there's some, well, you know, actors as well as I do, they'll start saying, who's she doing there, stealing the stage, upstaging me? There's all of that. So you have to be careful.
In those circumstances, if they want to, they'll step on it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And one of the other things in that show, which again, thank you, sweetheart, which he comes on, he's on his own, but he's pissed.
Yes.
He's a bit pissed. That's where he puts a record on. Girls were made to love and kiss, and who am I to interfere with this? And it's a recurring theme that goes through the three plays. Mm. So, but what happened was, he comes in and he's pissed, or he's well oiled, let's put it that way. So he comes in and he winds up the record, the old fashioned record player, and he puts the record on. Girls were made to love and kiss. So off it goes, lovely. And it occurred to me one night that, wait a minute, if I'm pissed, it's not that easy, is it? So what I did was I wound the machine up, switched it on, and then went to put the record on and couldn't find the hole. So it went like this. So he goes...
Round and round. Brilliant. Just blow through the hole.
Yeah.
Of course. It's so simple, isn't it?
Yeah. And for some reason, which is ridiculous, yet sort of obvious, of course that wasn't the thing. It's because you're pissed, love.
Yes.
That's all it is.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
No.
And yet it's funny.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing, isn't
it? Audience loved it.
You see, and that thing of realising that and then learning that through playing in front of an audience, you can then take that into a situation where the audience isn't there and yet know how they're going to react. So when you're rehearsing something, I remember... Well, I will talk about us rehearsing Only Fools and Horses, because you insisted on all of us. You said, don't go when you've rehearsed your scene. Stay. Stay in the rehearsal room with us. We'll be a company. And that's what you were saying about sharing it with your actors. I remember at the time being incredibly impressed with it and also really flattered. You said, stay. And if you've got any ideas, say them.
Yeah.
We'll all work together.
Yeah.
And so I stayed there all day watching you work. You know.
Yeah.
It was... great. And there's a little moment in it, in that episode that we were in, where you're on the phone talking to the people downstairs, and Nick takes your hand and slams it down on the thing. And you then go, ow, right, careful. Not in the script. They're just again and again and again throughout that episode.
Yeah.
There are little, just little moments. And that thing that you say of just embroidering.
That's it.
Making it more detailed.
Yes.
Adding layers to it all the time. Being able to know that if I do that, I know what an audience reaction will be because I've done that sort of thing before.
Yeah. And I learned from, strangely enough, Terry Scott, which you don't learn very much from Terry Scott because he was a difficult man. But what he did say to me, which is absolutely right, apropos of this conversation, you can't teach comedy, you learn it. And the first time he said that to me, I went away for a long time thinking, what do you mean, teach and learn? It's the same thing, isn't it? Because I'm a bit thick sometimes. But that was exactly right. That being out every night in the theatre and having the courage to have an instinct inside you saying, the audience is not... seem to be following this, or they're not enjoying it, or there's a gap here. There's a gap. How can I... It needs filling. And I've got to do something to entertain, because that, to me, was the most important driving force. But also I enjoyed to be honest, I enjoyed the reaction, people laughing, and I was going, you know, it's a bit like an opera singer, I suppose, you know, getting around for just singing a few clever notes that somebody else has written.
But also, as you say, the courage of it.
Yeah.
Because there is a possibility, always in that situation, you'll get no reaction.
Yes.
The thing you thought was funny wasn't funny.
Exactly.
They didn't think it was funny.
So what you then do, you tar it two or three times, and then you go, that's not going to work if I cut it. Forget that. Forget it. Let's move on. Let's go somewhere else.
Mm.
So I was very, very fortunate to be able to do all that over the years and years and years. And that is, for example, that Falling Through the Hatch, which everybody thinks was, you know, a great sort of coup. And where that came from was John Sullivan, the writer, who said to me one day, we were in the bar having a drink, and he said to me, I was in the bar the other night, the wine bar. So I said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, I saw this piece of business you might like to do. So I said, what's that? And he said, I saw this boat. I'm just standing there, you know, sitting there, and there's a boat at the bar. And he was leaning on the counter and he told me this.
Yeah.
He said, and what happened was, the barmaid went through the thing, left the counter up, the thing up, and he went to lean and he missed it and went up. And then he looked around to see if anyone had seen it, because he was sort of embarrassed. And he was sort of going, yeah, well, I meant to do that, you know, sort of thing. And so John said, shall we do it? And I said, yes, yeah. I said, but I'll fall through the hatch.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, but this bloke didn't. He just did. He said, I know, but I will fall through the hatch. So he said, well, why? What's that? So I said, because that's really funny, and I know it works. He said, how do you know? I said, because in farces, every farce I've been in, there is a settee in the middle of the stage, 9 times out of 10. And what I used to do was to lean on the edge of the settee, right, and say, and the thing I said to the vicar about was that, well, it wasn't really me, but what it was get and miss the back of the city.
Gone, yeah.
And big laugh, sometimes round of applause and all that.
And especially that thing, and I bet you always did the thing that you did in the Only Fools episode, which is you'd come back up and pretend it hadn't happened.
That's right, you know? Yes.
What?
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
You meant to do that.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, so you're quite right. You're quite right. But that's daring to do it as
absolutely.
Well. I'm gonna have a go at this.
You do something like that and it doesn't get a laugh.
Yeah.
You've taken a big risk and you look like a real fool.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the audience sort of go, which on occasions they have done, gone, ooh. But what I learned about that is a learning curve as well, because over the years that I'd done this in all the different farces I'd been in, I'd learned how to work it. And one of the little tricks of it is this. If you go to lean on it, and then as you lean, you look where you're going, and what happens is the audience go, oh, Christ, he didn't mean to do that, right? Because that's a natural reaction.
Mm.
That if you did miss that, your instinct to save your head is to, as your eyes tells your brain very quickly, to put your hand out to save yourself, but your knee goes as well.
That's the natural way to do it.
Yeah. Mm. So when you first start to do something like that, and you go, what? That didn't work by itself. But if you do this, you looking at you, the audience, and I lean off this and I'm still looking at you as I fall right the
and
way
you
through.
You never take your eyes off me.
Yes.
That is funny.
And that's the audience.
So anybody can look back at that clip and analyse it, and they will see all those moments in it.
Yeah.
It's not a simple piece of business.
No.
It's a thing that's developed over years and years and years.
Yes.
To that sort of perfection, which is why it was voted the funniest moment.
Well, I don't know, ever. I suppose so, but that you've just put your finger on it, that I was fortunate enough to learn.
Mm.
When I first did it, I scrabbled at it. It nearly happened by accident, and my hand slipped a bit, and I saved myself, I think, going back. And then I thought, I wonder if I did actually miss it. I wonder what would happen. So the next night I went out and missed it, and it got something.
Yeah.
It got something, and then I realised, but it doesn't get as much, and sometimes I heard the audience go, ooh, and I thought, but wait a minute, I think I'm hurting myself here. I'll just try and look at them as though I'm in command, I know what I'm doing. Right. Then that was the trick.
And there
That's
it is.
That's what it was.
Yes.
And it was wonderful.
Fantastic. So I would suggest, David, that there's the second item to go into the time capsule would have to be that thing from the Norman Conquest, the packet of cereals, the...
Kellogg's.
The cornflakes, yes.
Well, fruit and fibre.
Fruit and fibre.
Whatever. I wanted to do it, and it came out of the fact that no one was talking to Norman. Mm. He came down and he'd been at it with somebody and he was pissed, been pissed, sorry, and they were all giving him the cold shoulder.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and he was chattering away and everybody was ignoring him.
Yeah.
So then I thought, there's an opportunity here. Right, nobody's listening to me, no one's taking any notice, so I worked it out. I could do this piece of business. Squirt, hand shot, further left, quick, yeah, and he wore, as
I
you
can
know,
see it now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, when is that? Oh, my word, that's 50 years ago. I can still see it.
Well, that was great that you remembered that, because I hadn't. But it was an example of, I suppose, anecdotally, what we're putting in is it's the journey, not the arrival. Now, meaning that here I am, and touch wood, I've been very successful. And I'm very grateful for that. I've had all the twists and turns and up and down. But I did something that I was in love with, which was to entertain people. I was very fortunate in that. The other thing I was very fortunate about was that I wanted to be better than I was. And I was constantly searching. So what that gave me in every production that I'd been in, which I learned my trade, was working out pieces of business and how to do it. And I remember in Charlie's Aunt, for example, he has a dinner party with the girls, the ladies, and he has to eat, or an afternoon tea, whatever it is. And so I worked it all out, and it's written in the script that he entertains the ladies at afternoon tea, or whatever it was. And what I said was, all right, okay, after being on the stage for about a week, 2 weeks, and I thought, I know how to wind the girls up. So I said to the stage manager, give me a bowl with some lettuce on it. So, of course, I set it up to entertain the other actors, the actresses. And the reason I did it was to have them corpsing, right? But the difference was, if I get them corpsing, that's something the audience can see, as opposed, you know, as actors, you can do things to each other without the audience knowing it. I can make you laugh, but the audience doesn't see it.
It's sort of unfair on the audience, isn't it?
Yeah. But if you can bring them all in, do something that the actors hadn't seen before, but the audience had, and, well, it's magic. It's magic. And so what I did with that was, I was talking and cutting up this, and I realised if I cut a big lettuce leaf and I put it in my mouth, and all the lettuce leaf was hanging out, right?
Like some sort of toad.
Yes. And then I'd be trying to talk like this, and you now had never seen this before, so you would be starting to go, wouldn't it? So in order to get you to go even further, I started to sort of get the fork.
Poke it back.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Again, that's...
I would love to be on stage with that.
Yeah.
Particularly with the audience knowing. That's the thing, the audience knowing it. And actually, in your book, there's a fantastic bit, because I have to say, your book's been beautifully read for audiobook by some excellent actor. I can't remember his name, but he's very good. I'd listen to that if I were you.
I probably will listen to that, because I might learn a thing or two. I could pinch some of his intonation.
Yes. There was, in the book, you talk about going to see the Goons when you were a young man.
Yeah.
And that, again, that enjoyment of watching people enjoying doing their job.
You're absolutely right. So there are pieces of anecdotes and things in the book that I draw on, and that's very interesting that you point that out, that where did this all come from? Where did this spirit of danger, of madness sometimes, like I've just described with poking a bloody lettuce inside your face and pretending that you're Because he's supposed to be a woman.
Yes, and elegant and genteel.
You see, you put your finger in. Now, you've got those two things in your mind. I've got to be a woman, pretending to be. Mm. I've also got to be elegant, not upper class. But I'm a boy and a lad who's been forced into this situation. So he doesn't know how to be, to do that as a woman. So, but he does know when he gets a lettuce leaf, Christ, I've got a great lettuce leaf hanging out of my face. How am I going to... I've got to be elegant. So
I can't use my fingers.
No. So he uses a fork, doesn't he? And the knife.
So, of course.
Yes, so you see, it all has a link. Mm. All has a history. You can't just do things just out of the wind. They have to have a journey.
Yes, but does that come from that seeing sort of Sellers and Seacombe and them?
I suppose it did, and that's the other thing that was important that I tried to, I think, I hope, bring out in the book, is that thing that I've said, the journey, not the arrival. In other words, if you're doing something with a group of people, and in my case, fellow actors, that we're doing something that we love doing, and it's a joyable experience, whether it's a drama or not, the fact that you're entertaining and you're projecting a character or somebody that is outside yourself to them, that you are doing it instinctively to entertain, to make them enjoy what you are doing. It's quite a complex thing. But you mentioned that where it must have picked up somewhere. I loved when I saw The Goons working, which was mad humour that had its own mad logic of mad people, you know. And you had these actors doing silly voices and being really silly. But to watch them really enjoying themselves, and sometimes they were corpsing themselves silly and had to stop the recording and say, come out. Where were we, you know, and enjoy it. Yes. And they were all great friends, all having a great time, and including us, which was us live audience.
And people forget that you had an extraordinarily long radio career.
Yeah.
I mean, incredibly successful. You were in Weekending for forever.
Yes.
And then also, as a younger actor coming along and somebody going into that area, I was a big fan of the Jason Explanation. It inspired us to do many of the things that we did in... I did a show called Radioactive.
Yeah, remember that.
And many of the things that we did, I think we sort of...
Stole. Be honest.
We did an homage.
Oh, God, you use that. It's the second time you've used that. You know, as you pinch my business.
My entire career has been an homage.
Yes, exactly. And you're doing it again now.
I know. I'm doing an homage to you and Nick here. That's it, marvellous. All money goes to my son.
You bloody swine. You make sure he gives me something.
All right. I'll send it round to you.
Yeah.
So, shall we put The Goons into the time capsule as your third item, David?
Yeah. Eccles and grip pipe thin.
Wonderful.
And think, right, I love The Goons.
Wonderful.
Right, this seems to be a good point at which to take a short break for some adverts. But we will be back with David very soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome back. Okay, let's waste no more time and get straight back to Sir David Jason and find out what else he'd like to put in his time capsule.
It's very obvious, I think, when you read your book, the things that have been important to you.
Yeah.
I love the descriptions of you going to the movies and how much that world, that sort of bright, colourful, elegant world in the cinema in the 50s,
yeah.
When you've been, you know, through a war, they were still rationing, and outside is a grim world, really.
It was, and you know what, that reason, again, which we should remember, which incidentally, I'll say this to you, and remind me to tell you about that cinema experience with my mother and how much effect it had. But one of the areas that we've forgotten about, I say we, not you and I, but the modern way of working in film and television, there's been one or two graphic examples of this, is to internalize your performance.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, I will think myself into the state, the period, whatever it is, of the person that is living in that period, that social area, whatever it is, right? And I'll do it and make it totally real. But in doing so, I will then talk like this.
Mm.
And I'd say, so excuse me, I can't quite hear what you're saying. Listen, this is the way that I work. I'm in the character, I'm in the zone, I'm giving you reality, I'm giving you all of this, right? The directors seem to be frightened. Oh, dear. He's brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, hold on. You're absolutely doing nothing because you are trying to tell a story, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is your job.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to tell that story that has been given to you by a writer that you trust and believe in, and the story, because you are the actor, you've taken the job, is to make sure that what is written on that story, that journey, that once upon a time, gets to them,
yes.
The audience.
Yes.
So they have to hear everything you've got to say,
yes.
And the other actors as well. It's no good you going, listen, I'm in the zone here, pal, and I'm going to do it.
When even the sound man says, I can't hear what you're saying,
yeah,
then you're in trouble.
Well, I did, no names again, no Patrick, because I worked with a sound man who worked on one of those shows. It was television drama series. Not that long ago, I can't tell you the name of it again, but it was a, again, if I give it all away, but I'm trying to say it was a period piece,
okay.
Right? A period piece.
Yes.
And he'd studied the language of 17th century England, say.
Mm-hmm.
So we couldn't understand a word of it. And I happened to work with a sound man, and I said to him, did you see that show, and the other night? And he said, I couldn't understand a word. And he said, I was the sound man on that. I said, so it's you. It's your fault. Couldn't understand. He said, hold on.
Whoa, no.
He said, I told the director a number of times, I'm having a bit of a difficult, very polite, obviously, very careful, that difficult to understand what he's saying. And he said, I've already spoken to him. He's doing it exactly right. He's told me he was in period and all of this. So he's a genius. Now, the thing is, the director had got the script in front of him. Right? What he was saying, virtually no one could understand.
And the director, because he had the script in front of him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have to be very careful if you are an actor. Don't be that grand. That who do you think you are? Because it's not you and your, this is the way I work and this is all of that stuff. You've got to remember, you're doing it for them. They paid money to listen to a story,
yeah.
Piece of escapement, romance, a comedy. It doesn't matter what it is, but I've got to hear what you're saying. And if this is television or film, that's even more bloody important.
So is this a thing you want to put into the time capsule that you'd like to get rid of?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you have the right, I think, because you've done probably more drama than you've done comedy in your career, strangely.
Yeah.
I mean, Frost, you did loads and loads of it, and it's very serious stuff.
Yeah.
But as with all great serious stuff, sprinkled with very funny moments.
Yeah.
So things are touching because you've also fallen in love with the people.
Hopefully. Yes, and you've just reminded me of... Because I apply this to everybody. Everybody who's listening to your podcast is that it should apply to us all. If you can, if you're lucky enough to have something every day, your job, try and get something out of it, because your life is a journey. But if you can find something that you're aiming for to give yourself and someone else the pleasure of it, and I was, again, very, very lucky. And I've always had that in my mind. This is why I told you that story about an actor. Just remember, it's not you. It's not all about you. You've got nothing to do with it. You two should be working for them out there.
Yes, absolutely.
So
get over it.
Exactly. Yeah. Get over it, tough. Or get out. What was it? There was a story about Anthony Hopkins was working on a film, and he left the set, and the director then was giving the other actors for bollocking and shouting and raising his voice and saying how, you know, this, that and all the other. And Anthony Hopkins heard all this, came back onto the set and said to the director, just a second. I heard what you've been saying to the other actors. Don't be more polite. Just remember, this is not heart surgery, okay? And he left the set. Because that's true. There are ways in which you can talk to an actor and say, no, listen, come on, we got to, you know, and all of that, which we've all had. But mainly, it's all about us working as a team to get the best bit, story, whether it's a drama, whatever it is, out to that audience.
Yes.
And that story of finding bits that would fit, not doing it for any other reason, but the thing with Frost that I said, that he's a policeman, but he's a human being. So he's a person, he's a man who, you know, he's got a terrible job sometimes, and sometimes it's not so bad, but he loves his job and he hates the criminal, right? Mm. And there's one I remember that I came into the office, at the entrance where all the people come to, so to say, excuse me, where the desk is. And I came in and I said to this this actor, and I said, I had to say something like, well, any news? What is it? And they said, well, tell you what, the governor wants to see you, but, oh, yeah, what's that? Well, what he said was, and there's a little scene, right, with this. So I said to this actor, I said, I tell you what, why don't you have a cup of tea? He said, you have this cup of tea and have a sip of it and put it down, and then I'll come in, and then I will then go, yes, what is it? Oh, yeah, what? Yeah, mullet. What does he want? Right. You're telling you, and I took his tea. Yeah, so we had that. Which, okay, funny. So he then reacted and went, but didn't say anything. No. So I said, okay, right. Oh, well, I better be off. That's terrible. I ain't got any sugar. And
there you are.
And then he left him going, oh, I don't know whether I want to drink that now. And then we were off.
Absolutely,
somewhere.
Yeah. But now, my mother-in-law lives with me, Doreen. I'll give her a name check. You know, and Doreen. I went into her room yesterday afternoon, and she was watching Frost.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, I'm talking to that man tomorrow. And she said, oh, he's very funny. He's very new. He's always nicking people's food. And then she said something you'll be very pleased with. She said, you can always hear what he says.
Ah, there you are. And that is the answer to modern acting, modern actors. And what I think that a lot of them haven't come up through the theatre, they've come up through the media of television and film. And they then start getting in their head because they don't have an audience to react to them. They study the script and the part and they do. I'm not talking about everyone, but some of them. And they fall in love with their own ability to create whatever it is inside their head. Mm. And they have all these defense mechanisms about, I'm in the right period, I say it right, I'm getting it right here, yeah. and it's your job to get it there, and et cetera. You've heard all those stories. Mm. But the one thing that they forget is those people out there, it's once upon a time. You've got to tell them and make the story.
Yes. And it's not as if you're not doing that thinking. You're not, you know, that thought isn't through your head. It's perfectly clear. I'll go back to the episode of Only Fools that we did. One of my favourite lines in all episodes of it is when you're talking to Nick in the bar about him buying a condom. Remember that? Don't you? Too many jokes for you to ever remember them all.
No.
And unlike the rest of the world, you don't watch Only Fools and Horses every other week.
Well, I do sometimes.
Sometimes. But yeah. You're in the bar talking about it. He's saying that he's going on holiday with Cassandra, so he wants to be careful.
Right.
So he's bought down the mini mart. He went down there and bought comb and stuff, but he wanted to buy some condoms. And you say, well, that's very mature of you, very adult, you know, in this day and age, be safe, yeah. He said, but, you know, I tried to, but there's a stigma attached. And then there's a pause. And in that pause, you can see your brain working. And you then say the brilliant line, he says, there's a stigma attached. And you say, that's a bit of silver paper. You just throw that away.
You're absolutely right. Because if you had said, no, that's a bit of silver paper, you just throw that away. Okay, that's one way of doing it. But if you hold on to that moment, yeah. and you've already got the fact that Dell is not quite as, you know, bright as he'd like to be.
He's puzzled. He's puzzled yeah. by what his younger brother's just said. And you can see that puzzlement.
That's it.
And he's working it out.
Yeah.
And
oh,
then he realizes
I know what it is. It's that bit of paper on the lid.
So, that's what he's on about.
Yes.
Because he doesn't know the word stigma.
Exactly. Lovely.
And it's a lovely thing. The detail of it, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And again, the nice thing about playing that character was he's a human being, meaning, like everyone, sometimes he'll come across a word or something or some piece of information that he doesn't understand, but he thinks he should know, so he tries to bluff it out. And other times he gets affected with emotion, because there was one storyline in Fools and Horses where Rodney says something or other about his mother and the father. They were never around for Rodney when he was there, and Del suddenly loses it and says, what do you mean they weren't there? Don't you understand? He said, over the years, who has been up there? Who's put bread on the table? Me. I've been out there. I've been looking after you. And suddenly, this fool, bit of a buffoon, bit of a tink Jack the lad, suddenly becomes very real, very emotionally moved. Yeah. And he's nearly brought to tears by the fact that Rodney should say this about the family,
yeah.
about what he's done. So that ability to manipulate the character to entertain you, the audience, is part and parcel. But you've got to have that range as well, and treat that drama, if you like, with as much import as how you treat your comedy, if you like, everything else. It's not me that's doing it. It's the character that is embedded in me, but I've got to get it across to you.
Yeah.
That's always been my driving force, because you've had to listen to the audience in those days when you're in the theatre to get your things across. Yeah. And as I say, that you brought back some lovely memories. Of,
yeah, that's good. The point is, your life has not been all, you know, sunshine and roses. You know, you talk about in the book about working, doing pantomime in Newcastle and having a terrible cold. At Christmas 1979, I think.
That's
what it was. Staying in a hotel on your own, just not being able to get home for Christmas. And then also, when people read the book, they'll realise probably a thing they don't know is the number of times that you were knocked back, the number of times that you had shows that had all the potential to be great shows, and they didn't quite work. You know, they'll also find out about the fact of Dad's Army.
I won't
necessarily spoil it. People should read the book to find these things out. But do tell me about that thing you said remind you of, your mum in the cinema.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you did. I tell you what it was. We, like a lot of people, and, you know, you don't keep harping on about it, but very poor. No, we weren't poor, because we were brought up in just a hard working class family. And if you couldn't afford things, there was no such thing as credit cards and all this. You just couldn't have it.
No.
So as a kid, you'd go out to parcel shops and you'd see like dinky toys saying, oh, look, can I have that? No. Oh, why? Why? We can't afford it. End of.
Yeah.
So you were very, well, you might even cry sometimes. And well, no, we just can't afford it. But what we did used to do, my mother used to take me to the Muth cinema, as it was in those days. Twice a week we'd go, once for the Odeon, once for the Gaumont. And all those things that we used to see was the big American movies and all of this. The entertainers were the Three Stooges. Laurel and Hardy was my favourites of all time. They were the best, and they still are. But one of the things that I could not believe was there were films like with Doris Day and Rock Hudson, romantic comedies, right? And as a lad of about 12, 14 or whatever it was, sitting in the audience with such a respect for, we didn't have a fridge, for example. Leftover food was put in the oven or in a cupboard, I remember, to, you know, overnight or wherever it was. But to see a film, see someone like Rock Hudson just talking about breakfast and saying, hi, darling, I'm home, open a fridge and take out a chicken leg and say, anyway, so how did it go today? And then, you know, I used to think, yeah, how can they do that? Because my mother would go berserk if I did that, because that's for the family.
Yeah.
If we had a chicken leg that was left over, you couldn't just go and help yourself.
It's another meal.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
And a fridge the size of your pantry.
Yes. You know. So two things. America must have been like heaven. And for us to open a fridge was packed with food and to take out a chicken leg, which is the whole family's bleeding meal for a bleeding week for us. And he wrote up, look, it's getting late now.
Absolutely.
What have you got to say?
Before we finish, I've got something for you. So you can get on with your life. I've got,
be careful what you're taking out of that pocket.
I know. Well, I thought I ought to pay you back with that.
God. Did you get that?
Yeah. That's a Groovy Gang badge for you.
That's lovely.
You've never got to be a member of the Groovy Gang.
No, I didn't.
So
no.
Now you can be.
Oh, that's wonderful. How did you get it?
I nicked it.
Did you? Oh, that's a wonderful little... That was...
They had bags of them. So there you are. That's yours.
Bless you. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well,
it's been an absolute joy. Thank you, David.
It is. We could do a whole series.
We could. We? I'll come back and do it again.
Yes.
I'll pop round next week and we'll do next lesson for people.
Yeah. It's lessons to be learned. And yes. I suppose, in a way, you have reflected that in, which I hadn't really realised, is that's part of the journey of the book, is that way of learning through the process of doing a job that fortunately one enjoyed, but learning how to do things and how to enjoy things.
Yes, as much through your failures as through your successes.
Yes, right. You're absolutely right there as well. But
there's a phrase you use in the book where you say, you think a career is easy, but there's many a slip between cup and lip, that phrase. And when I read that, it made me think, yeah, but if there was a slip between cup and lip, you'd turn it into a routine.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Did you want some...
The good news is, because you pay your annual membership, and because of COVID and we've been shut down, we've got like £100 worth of credit. So the meal's free.
Bloody hell.
As they say, lovely jubbly.
Yes.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Sir David Jason. We never did quite get round to finding a fifth item for the time capsule, but I like to think David would put his Groovy Gang badge in there. We did get a masterclass in comic timing, though, didn't we? And there's plenty more in David's autobiography, A Dell of a Life, available, well, available everywhere, I should imagine. But we do have a link to it in the description of this episode, if you want to use that. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe to it on Apple, Acast, Spotify, Castbox, or wherever you usually get your podcasts. Please do rate us and leave a review if the opportunity presents itself. And you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for all the latest news about My Time Capsule. Just search at MyTCPod or at Fenton Stevens. This podcast was produced by John Fenton Stevens, and the music is by Past the Peas Music. It was a cast-off production. So, until next time, stay groovy. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.